They could destroy a moon. Those specks ruled the ink. An Imperator commands each fleet. A Praetor commands squadrons within that fleet. What I could do with that power. Augustus is haughty as he gives the speech. I swallow the bile in my throat. Because of the impossible distance of my enemies, my anger was once a cold, quiet sort. Now, it burns in me.
Society has three stages. Savagery, ascendance, decadence. The great rise because of savagery. They rule in ascendance. They fall because of their own decadence.
He tells us how the Persians were felled, how the Romans collapsed because their rulers forgot how their parents gained them an empire. He prattles about Muslim dynasties and European effeminacy and Chinese regionalism and American self-loathing and self-neutering. All the ancient names.
Our savagery began when our capital, Luna, rebelled against the tyranny of Earth and freed herself from the shackles of democracy, from the noble lie, the idea that men are brothers and are created equal.
Augustus weaves lies of his own with that golden tongue of his. He tells of the Golden's suffering. The masses sat on the wagon and expected the great to pull, he reminds. They sat whipping the great until we could no longer take it. I remember a different whipping.
Men are not created equal. We all know this. There are averages. There are outliers. There are the ugly. There are the beautiful. This would not be if we were all equal. A red can no more command a starship than a green can serve as a doctor.
There's more laughter across the square as he tells us to look at pathetic Athens, the birthplace of the cancer they call democracy. Look how it fell to Sparta. The noble lie made Athens weak. It made their citizens turn on their best general, Alcibiades, because of jealousy.
Even the nations of Earth grew jealous of one another. The United States of America exacted this idea of equality through force. And, when the nations united, the Americans were surprised to find that they were disliked. The masses are jealous. How wonderful a dream it would be if all men were created equal. But we are not. It is against the noble lie that we fight. But as I said before, as I say to you now, there is another evil against which we war. It is a more pernicious evil. It is a subversive, slow evil. It is not a wildfire. It is a cancer. And that cancer is decadence.
Our society has passed from savagery to ascendance, but like our spiritual ancestors, the Romans, we too can fall into decadence.
He speaks of the Pixies.
You are the best of humanity. But you have been coddled. You have been treated like children. Were you born to a different color, you would have calluses. You would have scars. You would know pain.
He smiles as if he knows pain. I hate this man.
You think you know pain. You think the society is an inevitable force of history. You think her the end of history. But many have thought that before. Many ruling classes have believed theirs to be the last, the pinnacle. They grew soft, fat. They forgot that calluses, wounds, scars, hardship preserve all those fine pleasure clubs you young boys love to frequent, and all those fine silks and diamonds and unicorns you girls ask for on birthdays.
Many Oriots have not sacrificed. That is why they do not wear this.
He shows a long scar on his right cheek. Octavia O'Loon has the same scar.
The scar of a peer. We are not the masters of the solar system because we are born. We are the masters because we, the peerless scarred, the iron golds, made it that way.
He touches the scar on his cheek. I'd give him another if I were closer. The children around me suck down this man's garbage like oxygen.
Right now, the colors who mine this planet are harder than you. They are born with calluses, born with scars and hatred. They are tough as nanosteel. Fortunately, they are also very stupid. For instance, this Persephone, you have no doubt heard of, is nothing more than a dim girl who thought singing a song was worth a hanging.
I bite a bloody hole in my cheek. My skin shivers from rage as I find out that my wife is part of this bastard speech.
The girl did not even know the video would be leaked. Yet it is her willingness to suffer hardship that gave her power. Martyrs, you see, are like bees. Their only power comes in death. How many of you would sacrifice yourself to not kill, but merely hurt your enemy? Not one of you, I wager.
I taste the blood in my mouth. I have the knife ring Dancer gave me, but I breathe the fury down.
I am no martyr. I am not vengeance. I am Io's dream, still, doing nothing while our murderer gloats feels like a betrayal.
In time you will receive your scars from my sword.
Augustus closes.
But first, you must earn them.
Chapter 17. The Draft.
Son of Linus and Lexus au Andromedus, both of the House Apollo. Would you prefer to mark yourself as requesting House Apollo preferentiality?
A tedious Oriot administrator asks me.
Goldbrow's first loyalty is to colour, then family, then planet, then house. Most houses are dominated by one or two powerful families. On Mars, the family Augustus, the family Bellona, and the family Arcos influence all others.
No, I reply.
He shuffles over his datapad. Very well. How do you believe you performed on the slang smarts test?
That is the extrapolational test, he clarifies.
I think my results speak for themselves. You are not paying attention, Darrow. I shall mark that against you. I am asking for you to speak for your results.
I think I took a gory piss on your test, sir.
Ah.
He smiles.
Well, you did. You did. House Minerva for brains might be right for you. Perhaps Pluto for the deviousness. Apollo for the pride. Yes. Well, I have a test for you. Please complete it to the best of your ability. Interviews will commence when you have finished.
The test is quick, and it is in the form of an immersion game. There's a goblet on a hill that I need to acquire. Many obstacles stand in my way. I pass them as rationally as possible, trying to hide my anger when a little elf steals a key I acquire. But every step of the way there's some damn setback, some inconvenience. And it's always unforeseen, it's always something beyond the bounds of extrapolation. In the end, I reach the goblet, but only after killing an annoying wizard and cruelly enslaving the race of elves by means of said wizard's magic wand. I could have left the elves be, but they annoyed me. Soon, the interviewers come in intervals. I learn they are called proctors. Each one of them is a peerless scard. They are chosen by the arch-governor to teach and represent the students of the house within the institute. All said, the proctors are impressive. There's a huge, scarred man with hair like a lion and a lightning bolt on his collar for Jupiter, a matronly woman with gentle golden eyes, and a quick-witted man with winged feet on his collar. He can't sit still, and his baby face seems immensely fascinated by my hands. He makes me play a game with him, in which he puts out both hands flat and facing up, and I put mine atop, facing down. He tries slapping my hands, but never quite manages. He leaves after clapping his hands together in joy. Another strange encounter comes when a beautiful man with coiled hair interviews me. A bow marks his collar. Apollo. He asks me how attractive I believe myself to be, and is displeased when I undershoot his estimate. Still, I think he likes me, because he asks me what I would like to be one day. An imperator of a fleet, I say. You could do great things with a fleet, but a lofty notion. He sighs, accenting every word with a feline purr. Perhaps too lofty for your family. Maybe if you had a benefactor of better familial origin. Yes, maybe then. He looks at his datapad. But unlikely due to your birth. Best of luck. I sit alone for an hour or more, till a sullen man comes to join me. His unfortunate face is pinched like a hatchet, but he has the scar, and a razor hilt hangs on his hip. His name is Fitchner. A wad of gum fills his mouth. The uniform he wears is black with gold, and it nearly conceals the slight belly paunch that sticks outward despite the faint smell of metabolizers. Like many of the others, he wears badges about his personage. A golden wolf with two heads decorates his collar, and a strange hand marks his cuff. They give me the mad dogs, he says. They give me the killers of our race, the ones full of piss and napalm and vinegar. He sniffs the air. You smell full of shit. I say nothing. He leans against the door and frowns as though it offended him in some way. Then back to me, sniffing improperly. Problem is, we of House Mars always burn out. Kids rule the Institute at first. Then they find out that napalm lasts about... He snaps his fingers. I have no reply. He sighs and props down in a chair. After a while of watching me, he stands and punches me in the face. If you punch me back, you will be sent home, pixie. I kick him in the shin. He limps away, laughing like a drunk Uncle Nero. I'm not sent home. Instead, I find myself escorted with 100 others into a large room with float chairs and a large wall dominated by ivory gridwork. The gridwork forms a checkerboard square on the wall, 10 rows high, 10 rows across. I'm taken on a lift to the middle row, some 50 feet off the ground. 99 other students are ushered in till each box is filled. This is the prime crop, the best of the students. I look out from my box, peering up above me. A girl's feet dangle out of the box above my head. Numbers and letters appear in front of my box, my statistics. Supposedly, I'm very rash, and have upper outlier characteristics in intuition and loyalty and, most noticeably, rage. There are 12 groups in the audience. Each group sits close together in float chairs around vertical golden standards. I see an archer, a lightning bolt, an owl, a wolf with two heads, an upside-down crown, and a trident, amongst others. One of the proctors accompanies each group. They alone do not have their faces covered. The others wear ceremonial masks, featureless and golden and slightly like the animals of their houses. If only I had known this was going to happen, I might have brought a nuke. These are the drafters, the men and women of highest prestige. Praetors and imperators and tribunes and adjudicators and governors sit there watching me, trying to choose the new students for their house, trying to find young men and women they can test and offer apprenticeships. With one bomb, I could have destroyed the best and the brightest of their golden rule. Maybe that's the rashness speaking. The draft begins when a titan of a Gen-Alt boy is chosen first to the House of the Lightning Bolt, House Jupiter. Then go more girls and boys of unnatural beauty and physical prowess. I can only guess they are geniuses as well. The fifth pick comes. The baby-faced interviewer with the winged feet floats up to me on golden boots. Several of the drafters of House Mercury float along with him. They speak quietly amongst themselves before asking me questions.
Who are your parents? What are their family's accomplishments?
I tell them about my modest, false family. One of them seems to think highly of a relative of mine who has long since passed away, but despite the proctor's objections, they pass me over for another student from a family with the ownership of 90 mines and a stake on one of Mars's southern continents. The Mercury proctor curses and shoots me a quick smile.
"Hope you're available next round,"
he says. Next goes a delicate girl with a mocking smile. I can barely pay attention, and, at times, it is difficult to see who else is being selected. We're arrayed in an odd way. With the 10th pick, the proctor who struck me in the interviews floats my way. There is disagreement among the drafters. I have two ardent advocates. One is as tall as Augustus, but her hair flows down to her spine in three golden braids. The second is broader, not very tall. He's old. Can tell by the scars and wrinkles on his thick hands. Hands that bear the signet ring of an Olympic knight. I know him immediately, even without seeing his face. Lorne Au Arcos, the Rage Knight, the third greatest man on Mars, who chose to serve the Society by safeguarding the Society's compact instead of reaching for crowns in politics. When he points to me, Fitchner grins. I am chosen 10th. 10th out of 1,000. Chapter 18. Classmates. I feel a sinking in my stomach as I walk with the chattering mass into the dining hall. It is over grand, white marble floors, columns, a hollow sky displaying birds in flight at sunset. The Institute is not what I expected. According to Augustus, the classes are to be hard on these little godlings. I snort down a laugh. Let a lot of them spend a year in a mine. There are 12 tables, each with 100 place settings. Our names float above the chairs in golden letters. Mine floats to the right of a table's head. It is a place of distinction. The first draft. A single bar floats to the right of my name. A minus one is to the left. The first to get 5 bars becomes primus of his house. Each bar is bounty for an act of merit. Apparently, my high score on the test was the first bit of merit.
Wonderful. A cutter in the lead for primus.
A familiar voice says.
The girl from the exam. I read her name. Antonia Au Severus. She has cruel good looks, high cheekbones, a smirking smile, scorn in her eyes. Her hair is long, full, and golden as Midas's touch. She was born to be hated and to hate. A -5 floats beside her name. It is the second closest score to mine at the table. Cassius, the boy I met at testing, sits diagonally across from me. A -6 shimmers by his broad smile. He runs a hand back through his curls. Another boy sits directly across from me. -1 and a golden bar float by his name. While Cassius lounges, this other boy, Priam, sits as straight as a blade. His face is celestial, his eyes alert, his hair coiffed. He's tall as me, but broad in the shoulders. I don't think I've ever seen a more perfect human being. A bloody damn statue. He wasn't in the draft, I discover. He is what they call a premier. They cannot be drafted. His parents chose his house. Then I discover why. His scandalous mother, a banner woman of the House Bellona, owns our planet's two moons. "Fate brings us together again," Cassius chuckles to me. "And Antonia, my love, it seems our fathers conspired to place us side by side." Antonia replies with a sneer. "Remind me to beam him a thank you." "Tony! No need for nastiness." He wags a finger. "Now toss me a smile like a good doll." She flips him the crux with her fingers. "Rather toss you out a window, Cassie."
"Rawr!"
Cassius blows her a kiss. She ignores it. "So, Priam, I suppose you and I will have to play gentle with these fools, eh?"
"Oh, they look like swell sorts to me,"
Priam replies primly.
"I fancy we'll do very well as a group."
They talk in high lingo.
"If the dregs of the draft don't weigh us down, my good man."
He gestures to the end of the table and starts naming them.
"Screwface, for obvious reasons. Clown, because of that ridiculous puffy hair. Weed, because, well, he's thin. Oi, you, you're Thistle, because your nose looks hooked as one. And that itty-bitty one right there next to the bronzy-looking fellow, that's Little Pebble."
"I think they will rather surprise you," Priam says in defense of the far end of the table. "They may not be as tall, or as athletic, or even as intelligent as you or me, if intelligence really can be measured by that test, but I do not think it charity to say that they will be the spine of our group. Salt of the earth, if you will. Good sort."
I see the small kid from the shuttle, Severo, at the very foot of the table.
The salt of the earth is not making friends. And neither am I. Cassius glances my -1. I see him concede that Priam might have scored better than he, but Cassius makes a point in saying he's never heard of my parents.
"So, dear Darrow, how did you cheat?"
he asks. Antonia glances over from her conversation with Arya, a small girl made of curling hair and dimples.
"Oh, come now, man," I laugh. "They sent quality control after me. How could I have cheated? Impossible. Did you cheat? Your score is high."
I speak the mid-lingo. It's more comfortable than the high-lingo fart-dust Priam jabbers on in.
"Me? Cheat?
No, just didn't try enough, apparently," Cassius replies. "If I had my wits, I'd have spent less time with the girls and more on studying, like you."
He's trying to tell me if he tried he could have done just as well, but he's too busy to put in as much effort. If I wanted him as a friend, I'd let him get away with it.
"You studied?" I ask.
I feel a sudden urge to embarrass him.
"I didn't study at all."
A chill goes through the air. I shouldn't have said it. My stomach plummets.
Manners.
Cassius's face sours and Antonia smirks. I've insulted him. Priam frowns. If I want a career in the fleet, then I will likely need Cassius Ao Bellona's father's patronage. Son of an imperator. Matteo drilled this into me. How easy it is to forget. The fleet is where the power is. Fleet, or government, or army. And I don't like government, not to mention that this sort of insult is how duels begin. Fear trickles down my spine as I realise how thin a line there is to tread. Cassius knows how to duel. I, for all my new skills, do not. He would rip me to pieces, and he looks like he wants to do just that.
I joke.
I tilt my head to Cassius.
Come on, man. How could I score so high and not have studied till my eyes were bleeding? Wish I'd spent more time fooling off like you. We're in the same spot now, after all. Fat lot that studying did for me.
Priam nods his approval at the peace offering.
I bet it was a slog, Cassius crows, tipping his head to acknowledge my peculiar breed of apology.
I expected the play to go over his head, thought his pride would blind him to my sudden apology. The gold may be proud, but he isn't stupid. None of them are. Have to remember that. After that, I do Matteo proud. I flirt with a girl named Quinn, befriend and joke with Cassius and Priam, who has probably never sworn in his life. Throw my hand out to a tall brute named Titus, whose neck is as thick as my thigh. He squeezes too hard, on purpose. He's surprised when I nearly break his hand, but damn is his grip strong. The boy is even taller than Cassius and I, and he's got a voice like a titan. But he grins when he realizes that my grip, if nothing else, is stronger than his. Something strange about his voice, though. Something decidedly disdainful. There's also a feather of a boy named Roke, who looks and speaks like a poet. His smiles are slow, few, but genuine. Rare.
Cassius! Julian calls.
Cassius stands and throws an arm around his thinner, prettier twin. I didn't piece it together before, but they are brothers. Twins. Not identical. Julian did say his brother was already in Aegea.
Darrow here is not what he seems, Julian tells the table with a very grave face. He has a knack for theatrics.
You don't mean...
Cassius puts a hand to his mouth. My finger grazes my steak knife.
Yes, Julian nods solemnly. No,
Cassius shakes his head.
He's not a Yorkton supporter.
Julian, tell me it isn't so.
Darrow. Darrow, how could you be?
They never win a game. Priam, are you hearing this?
I throw my hands up in apology.
A curse of birth, I suppose. I am a product of my upbringing. I cheer for the underdog.
I manage not to sneer the words.
He confessed it to me on the shuttle.
Julian is proud to know me. Proud his brother knows he knows me. He looks for Cassius's approval. Cassius isn't oblivious to this either. He gently doles out a compliment and Julian leaves the high drafts and returns to his mid-draft seat, halfway down the table, with a content smile and squared shoulders. I didn't think Cassius would be the kind sort. Of those I meet, only Antonia openly dislikes me. She doesn't watch me like the others at the table. From her, I feel only a distant breed of contempt. One moment she's laughing, flirting with Roke, and then she feels my gaze and becomes ice. The feeling is mutual. My dormitory is from a dream. Gold trim lines a window that looks out into the valley. A bed is laden with silks and quilts and satins. I lie in it when a pink masseur comes in and stays for an hour, kneading my muscles. Later, three lithe pinks file through to tend to my needs. I send them to Cassius's room instead. To calm the temptation, I take a cold shower,
and immerse myself in a hollow experience of a digger in the mining colony Corinth. The helldiver in the hollow experience is less talented than I was, but the rattling, the simulated heat, the darkness and the vipers, they comfort me so much that I wrap my old scarlet rag around my head. More food comes. Augustus was all talk, gob full of exaggerations. This is their version of hardship. I feel guilty as I fall asleep with a full stomach, clutching the locket with Io's flower inside. My family will go to bed hungry tonight. I whisper her name. I take the wedding band from my pocket and kiss it. Feel the ache. They stole her. But she let them. She left me. She left me tears and pain and longing. She left me to give me anger, and I cannot help but hate her for a moment, even though beyond that moment there is only love. Io, I whisper, and the locket closes. Chapter 19. The Passage. I vomit as I wake. A second fist strikes my full stomach, then a third. I'm empty and gasping for air. Drowning in my sick, coughing, hacking, I try to scramble away. A man's hand grabs me by the hair and throws me into the wall. God, he's bloody strong. And he's got extra fingers. I reach for my knife ring, but they've already dragged me into the hall. I've never been so manhandled. Even my new body can't recover from their strikes. There's four of them in black. Crows. The killers. They've discovered me. They know what I am. It's over. All over. Their faces are expressionless skulls. Masks. I pull the knife I took from dinner from my waist, and I'm about to stab one of them in the groin. Then I see the flash of gold on their wrists, and they hit me till I drop the knife. It's a test. Their strikes against a higher colour are sanctioned by the issuer of the bracelets. They haven't found me out at all. A test. That is what this is. It is a test. They could have used stunners. There's a purpose to the beating. It's something most Gauls have never experienced, so I wait. I curl up and let them beat me. When I don't resist, they think they've done their job. They sort of do. I'm ragged shit by the time they're satisfied. I'm dragged through the hallway by men nearly 3 meters tall. A bag is shoved over my head. They're staying away from technology to scare me. I wonder how many of these kids have felt physical force like this. How many have been so dehumanized? The bag smells like death and piss as they drag me along. I start laughing. It's like my bloody damn fry suit. Then a fist hits my chest and I crumple, gasping. The hood also has a sound device installed. I'm not breathing hard, but my breaths come back louder than they should. There are over 1,000 students. Dozens at a time must suffer this same fate. Yet I hear nothing. They don't want me to hear the others. I'm supposed to think I'm alone, that my colour means nothing. Surprisingly, I find myself offended that they dare strike me. Don't they know I'm a bloody damn gold? Then I snort back a laugh. Effective tricks. I'm lifted up and thrown hard onto a floor. I feel a vibration, the smell of exhaust. Soon, we're in the air. Something in the bag covering my head disorients me. I can't tell which direction we're flying, how high we've risen. The sound of my own raspy breath has become terrible. I think the bag also filters out oxygen because I'm hyperventilating. Still, it's not worse than a fry suit. Later. An hour? Two? We land. They drag me by my heels. My head bumps on stone, jarring me.
It's not till much later that they take the bag off my head in a barren stone room lit by a single light. Another person is already here. The crows strip away my clothing, rip away the precious Pegasus pendant. They leave.
Cold in here, Julian. I chuckle as I stand, unclenching my left hand from the dirty red Helldiver's sweatband. My voice echoes. We're both naked. I fake a limp with my right leg. I know what this is.
Darrow? Is that you? Julian asks. Are you well?
I'm prime. They busted up my right leg, though. I lie. He stands, too, pushing himself up with his left hand. That's his dominant one. He looks tall and feeble in the light, like bent hay. I caught more kicks and punches than him, though. Loads more. My ribs might be cracked.
What do you think this is?
He asks. The passage, obviously.
But they lied. They said it would be tomorrow.
The thick wooden door squeals on rusted hinges, and Proctor Fitchner saunters in, popping a bubblegum.
Proctor? Sir, you lied to us! Julian protests.
He pushes his pretty hair back out of his eyes. Fitchner's movement is sluggish, but his eyes are like a cat's. Lying takes too much effort, he grunts idly.
Well, how dare you treat us like this? Julian snaps. You must know who my father is, and my mother is a legate. I can have you up on charges for assault in a moment's notice. And you hurt Darrow's leg.
It's 1 a.m, dipshit. It's tomorrow. Fitchner pops another bubblegum. There are also two of you. Alas, only one spot is available in your class.
He tosses a golden ring, emblazoned with the Wolf of Mars and a star shield of the Institute, onto the dirty stone ground.
I could make it ambiguous, but you look like rusty-headed lads. Only one comes out alive.
He leaves the way he came. The door squeals, and then slams shut. Julian flinches at the sound. I do not. We both stare at the ring. And I have a sick feeling in my gut that I'm the only one in the room who knows what just happened.
What do they think they're doing? Julian asks me. Do they expect us to...
kill each other? I finish.
Yes. That's what they expect. Despite the knot in my throat, I ball my fists, Io's wedding band tight on my finger.
I intend to wear that ring, Julian. Will you let me have it?
I am bigger than he, not quite as tall, but that doesn't matter. He doesn't stand a chance.
I have to have it, Darrow,
he murmurs. He looks up.
I am of the family Bellona. I can't go home without it. Do you know who we are? You can go home without shame. I can't. I need it more than you.
We're not going home, Julian. One person comes out alive. You heard him.
They wouldn't do that.
He tries.
No.
Please. Please, Darrow. Just go home. You don't need it like I do. You don't. Cassius... he would be so ashamed if I didn't make it. I wouldn't be able to look at him. Every member of my family is scarred. My father is an imperator. An imperator! If his son did not even make it through the passage, what would his soldiers think?
He would still love you.
Mine would. Julian shakes his head. He takes a breath and stands tall.
I am Julian O. Bellona, of the family Bellona, my goodman,
I don't want to do this. I can't explain how badly I don't want to hurt Julian. But when has what I wanted ever mattered? My people need this. Io sacrificed happiness and her life. I can sacrifice my wants. I can sacrifice this slender princeling. I can even sacrifice my soul. I make the first move toward Julian.
Darrow, he murmurs. Darrow was kind in Lycos. I am not. I hate myself for it. I think I'm crying because my vision is unclear. The rules and manners and morals of society are pulled away. All it takes is a stone room and two people needing the same scarce thing. Yet the shift isn't instantaneous. Even when I punch Julian in the face and his blood smears my knuckles, it doesn't seem a fight. The room is quiet, awkward. I feel rude punching him, like I'm acting. The stone is cold on my feet. My skin prickles. Breath echoes. They want me to kill him because he didn't do well on their tests. This is a mismatch. I am Darwin's scythe. Nature scraping away the chaff. I don't know how to kill. I've never killed a man. I have no blade, no thumper, no scorcher. It seems impossible that I could make this boy of meat and muscle bleed dry just with my hands. I want to laugh, and Julian does. I am a naked child, slapping at another naked child in a cold room. His hesitancy is obvious. His feet move like he's trying to remember a dance. But when his elbows come to eye level, I panic. I don't know how he is fighting. He strikes half-heartedly at me in a foreign, artistic way. He's tentative, slow, but his timid fist gets my nose. Rage overtakes me. My face goes numb. My heart thunders. It's in my throat. My veins prickle. I break his nose with a straight. God, my hands are strong. He wails and ducks into me, grappling my arm into an odd angle. It pops. I use my forehead. It takes him just at the bridge of his nose. I grab the back of his neck and hit him again with my forehead. He can't break away. I do it again. Something cracks. Blood and spit lather my hair. His teeth cut my scalp. I drop back like I'm dancing, reverse off my left foot, weave forward and hit him with all my weight behind my right fist in his chest. My helldiver knuckles shatter his reinforced sternum. There's a great wheezing gasp and a crackling noise like snapping twigs. He tips backward onto the ground. I'm dazed from striking him with my forehead. Seeing red, seeing double, I stumble toward him. Tears stream down my cheeks. He's twitching. When I grab his golden hair, I find him already limp, like a wet golden feather. Blood pulses from his nose. He is quiet. He no longer moves. No longer smiles. I mutter my wife's name as I fall to cradle his head. His face has become like a blood blossom. Part 3. Gold. This is your sling blade, son. It'll scrape the earth's veins for you. It'll kill pit vipers. Keep it sharp. And if you get stuck in the drills, it'll save your life for the price of a limb. So said my uncle. Chapter 20. The House of Mars. There's a stillness in my soul as I look at the broken boy. Even Cassius would not recognize Julian now. A cavity is carved into my heart. My hands tremble as the blood dribbles off them onto the cold stone. Rivers along the golden sigils upon my hands. I am a hell diver, but the sobs come even as the tears are gone. His blood trickles from my knee down my hairless shin. It's red, not golden. My knees feel the stone and my forehead touches it as I sob till exhaustion fills my chest. When I look up, he is still dead. This wasn't right. I thought the society only played games with its slaves. Wrong. Julian didn't score like I did on the tests. He wasn't as physically capable as I. So he was a sacrificial lamb. 100 students per house, and the bottom 50 are only here to be killed by the top 50. This is just a bloody damn test. For me. Even the family Bologna, powerful as they are, could not protect their less capable son. And that is the point. I hate myself. I know they made me do this, yet it still feels like a choice, like when I pulled Io's legs and felt the snap of her small spine. My choice. But what other choice was there with her? With Julian? They do this to make us wear the guilt. There's nowhere to wipe the blood, only stone and two naked bodies. This is not who I am, who I want to be. I want to be a father, a husband, a dancer. Let me dig in the earth. Let me sing the songs of my people and leap and spin and run along the walls. I would never sing the forbidden song. I would work. I would bow. Let me wash dirt from my hands instead of blood. I want only to live with my family. We were happy enough. Freedom costs too much. But Io disagreed. Damn her. I wait, but no one comes to see the mess I've made. The door is unlocked. I slip the golden ring over my finger after I close Julian's eyes, and I walk naked into the cold hall. It is empty. A soft light guides me up never-ending stairs. Water drips from the subterranean tunnel's ceiling. I use it to try to clean my body, but all I do is lather the blood into my skin, thinning it. I cannot escape it. What I've done, no matter how far I follow the tunnel. I am alone with my sin. This is why they rule. The peerless scarred know that dark deeds are carried through life. They cannot be outrun. They must be worn if one is to rule. This is their first lesson. Or was it that the weak do not deserve life? I hate them. But I hear them. Win. Bear the guilt. Reign. They want me pitiless. They want my memory short. But I was raised differently. All my people sing of are memories, and so I will remember this death. It will burden me as it does not burden my fellow students. I must not let that change. I must not become like them. I'll remember that every sin, every death, every sacrifice is for freedom. Yet now I'm afraid. Can I bear the next lesson? Can I pretend to be as cold as Augustus? I now know why he did not flinch in hanging my wife. And I'm beginning to understand why golds rule. They can do what I cannot.
Though I am alone, I know I will soon find others. They want me to soak in the guilt for now. They want me lonely, mournful, so that when I meet the others, the winners, I will be relieved. The murders will bind us, and I'll find the company of the winners a salve to my guilt. I do not love my fellow students, but I will think I do. I will want their comfort, their reassurances that I am not evil. And they will want the same. This is meant to make us a family. One with cruel secrets. I am right. My tunnel leads me to the others. I see Roke, the poet, first. He bleeds from the back of his head. Blood is slick on his right elbow. I didn't think him capable of killing. Whose blood? His eyes are red from crying. We find Antonia next. Like us, she is naked. She moves like a golden ship, drifting along, quiet and aloof. Her feet leave bloody footprints where she walks. I dread finding Cassius. I hope he is dead, because I'm afraid of him. He reminds me of Dancer, handsome, laughing, yet a dragon just beneath the surface. But that's not why I'm afraid. I'm afraid because he has a reason to hate me, to want to kill me. No one in my life has had just cause before. No one has ever hated me. He will, if he finds out. Then I realize it. How could the house ever be knit tightly with such secrets? It can't. Cassius will know someone here killed his brother. Others will have lost friends, and so the house will devour itself. The society did this on purpose. They want chaos. It will be our second test. Tribal strife. The three of us find the other survivors in a cavernous stone dining hall, dominated by a long wooden table. Torches light the room. Night's mist slithers through open windows. It is like something from the old tales, the times they call medieval. Toward the far end of the long room is a plinth. A giant stone towers there. Embedded in its center is a golden primus hand. Golden and black tapestries flank the stone. A wolf howls upon the tapestries, as though calling out a warning. It is the primus hand that will tear this house apart. Each one of these little princes and princesses will think themselves deserved of the honor of leading the house, yet only one can. I move like a ghost with the other students, drifting around the stone halls of what seems to be a giant castle. There is a room in which we are to clean ourselves. A trough runs icy water along the cold floor. Now blood runs with the water to the right and disappears into the stone. I feel like some sort of spectre in a land of fog and rock. Black and gold fatigues are laid out for us in a relatively barren armory. Each student finds the fatigue bundle tagged with his or her name. A golden symbol of a howling wolf marks the high collars and sleeves of our clothing. I take my clothing with me and dress alone in some storage room. There, I fall into the corner and sit, silent. This place is so cold and quiet, so far from home. Roke finds me. He's striking in his uniform, lean like a strand of golden summer wheat, with high cheekbones and warm eyes, but his face is pale. He sits on his haunches across from me for several minutes before he reaches over to clasp my hands. I draw back, but he holds on till I look at him. "If you are thrown into the deep and do not swim, you will drown," he says, and raises his thin eyebrows. "So, keep swimming, right?" I force a chuckle. "A poet's logic." He shrugs. doesn't count for much. So I'll give you facts, brother man. This is the system. The lower colours have their children by use of catalysts. Fast births, sometimes only 5 months of gestation before labour is induced. Except for the obsidians, only we wait 9 months to be born. Our mothers receive no catalysts, no sedatives, no nucleics.
Have you asked yourself why?
So the product can be pure.
And so that nature is given a chance to kill us.
The Board of Quality Control is firmly convinced that 13.6213% of all Gold children should die before 1 year of age. Sometimes they make reality fit this number. He splays out his thin hands.
Why?
Because they believe civilization weakens natural selection. They do nature's work so that we do not become a soft race. The passage, it seems, is a continuation of that policy. Only we were the tools they used. My victim was, bless his soul, a fool. He was from a family of no worth, and he had no wits, no intelligence, no ambition. He frowns at the words before sighing. He had nothing the board values. There is a reason he was to die.
Was there a reason Julian was to die? Roke knows what he does because his mother is on the board. He loathes his mother, and only then do I realize I should like him. Not only that, I take refuge in his words. He disagrees with the rules, but he follows them. It is possible. I can do the same until I have power enough to change them.
We should join the others, I say, standing. In the dining hall, our names float above the chairs in golden letters. Our test scores are gone. Our names have also appeared beneath the primer's hand in the black stone. They float, golden, upward toward the golden hand. I'm closest, though there's still much distance to cover. Some of the students cry together in small groups by the long wooden table. Others sit against the wall, heads in hands. A limping girl looks for her friend. Antonia glares over at the table where small Severo sits eating. Of course, he's the only one with an appetite. Frankly, I'm surprised he survived. He is tiny, and was our 99th and last draft pick. By Roke's proposed rules, he should be dead. Titus, the giant, is alive and bruised. Those knuckles of his look like a dirty butcher's block. He stands arrogantly apart from the rest, grinning like this is all splendid fun. Roke speaks quietly with the limping girl, Leah. She falls down crying and throws her ring. She looks like a deer, eyes wide and glistening. He sits with her and holds her hand. There's a peacefulness to him that is unique in the room. Wonder how peaceful he seemed when strangling some other kid to death. I roll my ring on and off my finger. Someone smacks my head lightly from behind.
Oi, brother man!
Cassius, I nod.
Cheers to your victory. I was worried you were all brains.
Cassius laughs. His golden curls are not even tousled. He throws an arm around me and surveys the room with a wrinkled nose. He feigns this nonchalance. I can tell he's worried.
Ah, is there anything more ugly than self-pity? All this crying?
He smirks and points at a girl with a busted nose.
And she just became aggressively unpleasant. Not that she was ever much to sniff at, eh? Eh?
I forget to speak.
Shell-shocked, man. They get your windpipe. Just not much for joking about right now, I say. Took some knocks to the head. Shoulder's a bit slagged, too. This isn't my usual scene. Shoulder can be fixed straight off. Let's get it back in the socket.
He casually grips my dislocated shoulder and jerks it into its socket before I can protest. I gasp in pain. He chuckles. Prime. Prime. He slaps me on the same shoulder.
Help me out, won't you?
He extends his left hand. His dislocated fingers look like lightning bolts. I pull them straight. He laughs with the pain, not knowing his brother's blood is under my fingernails.